Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Patricia lets her campfire draw her further into the past. She remembers how she longed for her freedom. There is a legend claiming local tribes put a curse on the Grand Ronde Valley, where Le Grand sits sheltered by a landmass known as Mount Emily. Supposedly, they made sure every white person who chose to live there would have trouble in their relationships. Of course, I didn't know about the curse back then, but I used to be haunted by images of Mark's demise, used to watch me standing in black hat and veil, western dress, cowboy boots, the American flag draped, and seven cops standing in a row, pointing rifles skyward 1, 2, 3 times for a total of 21 shots. I used to be haunted by images of the caravan skidding down I-84, burning a scar across my life, voiding the word motherhood. Was it rehearsal? Foreshadowing? All I know is I dreamed of living in wildflowers without a carpet of eggshells, without the volatile EKG of police officer charm and rage. At parties, police wives used to joke about what they'd do if their husbands were ever shot in the line of duty. Have dispatch radio other officers and tell them to drag the body to the post office. Police officer spouses got an extra $100,000 if an officer died defending federal property. I don't know. Perhaps the West is still wild and the land infiltrates. Certainly men here seem to be logically engineered, more like elk, most happy with a herd of women from which to choose. In these open, available spaces, where there's room to spread out and comparatively ample land for growing food, maybe it makes sense that a man should want to send his seed as far as it will go. In Kentucky, where we were pinned between the narrow flanks of wooded hills with little bottom ground and too many mouths, it made just as much sense for a man to take leave of his wife, as they often did, in favor of a prepubescent son or not yet fertile daughter. I once heard tell that in the ways of the old Celts, the oldest daughter of a tribe's chief was made the property of her fellow clansmen for just that purpose. Chapter 2. The Walk is a Circle. East. The Nez Perce Reservation's western boundary lies east of Lewiston, Idaho, at the confluence of the Snake and Clearwater Rivers. On the day I traveled with Brett and Zach to take a look at the Indian Health Service facility at Lapway, to help me decide whether I wanted to apply for the public health nurse job, I felt intimidated by the sights and sounds of such a big place, but mostly the smells. It took 2 hours of winding east from Le Grand along the Tinselquick Minum River to the great green bowl of the Wallawas, then to Enterprise, circumscribed by glacial peaks and the Eagle Cap Wilderness, then another 2 hours along Washington's easterly edge over treed mountain passes with names like Snow Hollow Hill and Rattlesnake Grade, earned by its hairpin turns and goatish drop-offs to the Grand Ronde River below, to Lewiston, and then our collective moan over the odor of a paper mill. The smell was fermented and musty and muffled whatever else the air held as we made our way through the business district past shops called Michaelbust and Palucci, a bar called Tomfoolery, home of the Effie Burger, the Anytime Tavern, Black Sheep Sporting Goods, Curly's Alibi, My stomach, geared to the one-horse traffic of La Grande, stayed cued against a mishap. Eventually, the road relaxed, merged into a two-lane, then four as we turned east to follow the Clearwater. The factory we'd been smelling jutted unexpectedly from the horizon like a reverse comet. It was a blue-collar monstrosity, a congress of blinking lights, steam, conformed steel. I imagined giant rocker arms churning vats of magma, rusty cogs turning room-sized wheels, shirtless men burnished from the heat groaning in pairs against rough-hewn spokes, sweat on muscled backs dampening the folds of pants, generating that smell, the smell of money. And then, a mile or two down Highway 95, there it was, the sign, white on green, entering the Nez Perce Indian Reservation. Dear stomach. I felt dismantled, as if my blood had polarized, the Cherokee portion knowing its purpose, the rest not. I spotted a modular building north of the highway under a giant peace pipe and pulled in. Smoke shop, it read. My first glimpse at the inside left me dumbfounded. Racks of beaded feather things were one thing, and I should have expected the cartons upon cartons of cigarettes. But shelves of Pepsi 12-packs, Nutter Butters, Chips Ahoy, Oreos? Weren't these people battling diabetes? But the woman behind the counter at the smoke shop didn't look like she had diabetes. Diabetes, the silent killer. 45, oak skin, braided hair, navy blue where the light hit. And so the meaning of raven hair, I realized. Her hair was exactly the color of ravens in sunlight, or the tails of magpies. A small fan blew her cigarette smoke. She wore Wranglers and a belt with a rodeo buckle. Neat navy blue piping on her cowboy shirt. She was reading the Lewiston Morning Tribune. I asked, "Can you tell me where the Indian Health Service is?" After a wait and a sigh, she said, "Turn right before Valley Foods, in it," in a monotone lifting certain syllables. In it. So you turn into Valley Foods or into town? The woman shook her head, lowered it back to the newspaper, muttered something like, "These and so pole," which I was to learn was "These and Soyapo," or "asshole white person." Turn before Valley Foods, before Donald's, before Get Valley Gas. In it, she said. The clinic is behind the agency. The North Idaho Service Unit of the Indian Health Service turned out to be a 1950s-era modular building plus two aging single-wide house trailers sitting against a rustling, weed-covered hillside behind the Nez Perce Tribal Agency's building and the Piney-Wass Community Center on the central southern edge of Lapway. It took two more phone calls at Valley Foods and an escort by a Mr. Picone, the service unit director, or SUD as he was referenced, to find my way there. Brett and Zach, by that time, were begging. "We don't want to live on an Indian reservation, Mom," they chanted, as we waited in the parking lot of the grocery store for Mr. Picone to arrive. Indian people streamed by, no different than the patrons of any other grocery store, except for their dress. A wrinkled man with long white hair stopped to stare. Two men with braids and a large woman in a bandana kerchief herded a troop of t-shirted brown children into the store. Good-looking, sharply dressed teenagers piled out of late-model automobiles. Mr. Picone arrived in a brand-new red pickup, the dealer advertisement still obscuring the spot where his Idaho vehicle plate should be. He was dressed in casual office, dark pleated pants, a cotton shirt and tie. His cologne passed through the air ahead of his handshake, which remained limp even though mine was strong. His complexion had a worn look, not pocked exactly, but roughened, marking his age at 50, maybe 55. His cheeks were full, Dizzy Gillespie, the color of sandstone or sun-bleached pine needles, and he understated his stride, as if walking to the bathroom at a cocktail lounge or taking a girl to a movie for the first time. I see this next part as if I were staring through a cheap camera lens, one that requires you to stand a certain distance from your subject before the edges of the image clears. Only I am standing too close or too far away because I can't quite see what is on the mind of that version of me. In my blurry vision, she looks like a little girl herself. But if I could see her, I think I'd say first that her hair is blonde enough. She doesn't need those foil-wrapped streaks she'll soon pay $80 to have applied. And she doesn't look as nervous as she feels. And she shouldn't feel so bad about her marriage breaking up. Mark did, after all, impregnate her a third time and insist she have an abortion, even though she did, after all, sleep alone through most of the marriage, first on the mattress in Hollywood frame bought cheap early in the relationship, while he slept on the high-priced waterbed he'd so wanted until he began having trouble with gastric reflux and sold it. And then finally, on a brass knob day bed, she saved her nurse job dollars to buy, evidence of the artistic divide between the two, husband and wife, all those curly cues, all that white paint. This man who did not know sperm is thicker than water. And she shouldn't feel her hillbilly heritage so. She shouldn't think of it as some great scarlet A requiring apology or denial, and she doesn't need the folder of forms and statistical data representing the sum of her work at County Health, the 2 years she spent developing programs for children and migrants who harvested cherries in the Grand Ronde Valley. She doesn't need the copy of the article she wrote and published in Oregon Nurse, and she doesn't even need the copy of that videotape from the Eugene, Oregon news station, a report about a day in her life as a rural public health nurse. What she doesn't know is that Mr. Picone made his decision the moment he shook her hand. She passed a test he can't describe in human speak of any kind. In the words he would use from his critical care bed in Spokane 2 months later, after he suffers a silent but widespread heart attack, he just knew. And because I can't move the camera closer in or out, I can't clarify this next bit for her either, although I'd like to, because I'd like to save her a decade of guilt. I'd like to tell her there is no auger plate for children. They all end up damaged in some way. If we as parents don't do it, then more sinister outside means. Children must learn to endure, and adults must be reminded of it because that's what life is. Bits of happiness linked by stretches of endurance. Or maybe I would take away the scene completely. Maybe she left her children home that day. Maybe their father took the afternoon off and spent it shopping with them in Pendleton or fishing the Grand Ronde River. Maybe Brett and Zach did not come into Mr. Picone's office with faces splotchy and puffed, sucking their breaths against sobbing. Maybe they did not stand beside her choking on bones of fear and anger from a brotherly cleaving that would never reseal, while she merely asked, "Did you find a playground?" And the other part, the part where Brett speaks hoarse as an old man, voice drenched in practice at subletting his anger, his hands curling and uncurling, the fists of a baby, slow at first, then quickly, jaw clenching as he works to keep his shoulders straight, fighting his own normalcy, the slight hunch he inherited from her side of the family, saying, "Some Indian kids jumped me and beat me up, and Zach just stood there. He just stood there. He didn't even try to help me."
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
Ollie, oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I.
Patricia and her sons pay a visit to the Nez Perce reservation to decide if she wants to apply for the public health nurse's job. And maybe she did not hear the snotty ball from low in her eldest son's belly, a sound she'd heard only once before, and that when his father shot the family dog for refusing to chase a pheasant, and the tattered explanation from his brother, "I didn't know I wouldn't. I always thought I would, but I was scared, Mom. I was scared. I'm sorry, Brett. I'm sorry, man." Or maybe if I had let her hear and see all these things, I would make her tune in on this one line and insist she take it to heart. "I don't want to live on an Indian reservation, Mom." But that is not what happens in the fuzzy picture. In the fuzzy picture, she merely sits. Mr. Picone says, "It is wrong what these children did to you. I'm embarrassed and ashamed on behalf of my people. I offer my apology and a promise to have it looked into." Should I tell her she hadn't the mechanism to know she'd been wronged, that she came from a passive people who were not used to demanding justice, that she was worn from years of college and a new career and single parenting, even all that time she'd had the father in the house? Or should I just let her listen to what Mr. Picone says, let her learn her own lessons, and then, 15 years later, learn how to move on? Mr. Picone stands and doesn't extend his hand. He says, "I do have another appointment. I was expecting you sooner." "When will you make your decision?" she asks. "I will have to review the other applications," he says. And so we leave her there, walking to her black cherry Dodge Caravan, Brett crying and Zach spewing his defenses. We watch her survey the dryness of the place, hear the static in her heart as she tries to decipher whether demons or angels are driving her, and the long dark night to follow as she lies awake wondering how, despite 3.5 decades of living, there isn't a shred of wisdom spurring her to make the injustice right. When you accept a job with the Indian Health Service, you learn the mother of the Indian Health Service is the U.S. Public Health Service, which is an offspring of the uniformed services and therefore a sibling of the armed forces, which is comprised of the Army, Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines. You are given a book by Fitzhugh Mullen, M.D., called Plagues and Politics, The Story of the United States Public Health Service, which tells you the Public Health Service began as an act of Congress in 1798 to provide for the relief of sick and disabled seamen from ailments such as syphilis, gonorrhea, and TB. You learn that the law ended up having a profound effect on Western migration as it paid for the construction of marine hospitals in Cleveland, Chicago, St. Louis, Louisville, basically any place where water commerce was critical. It tells you Wisconsin Senator Timothy Otis Howe said in 1870, "One way to start a town in the West, if it was anywhere on a stream or a good-sized puddle, was to get an appropriation for a marine hospital." Put another way, it tells you our most cultured American cities began as treatment centers for sexually indiscriminate enlisted men. It also tells you that by the late 1880s, the Marine Hospital Service was treating 50,000 sailors a year. The network of physicians and nurses was so extensive that on January 4, 1889, President Grover Cleveland signed an act to regulate appointments in the Marine Hospital Service of the United States, establishing the Commissioned Corps of the Marine Service Hospital, the name changing once again in 1912 to the United States Public Health Service. It reminds you, as you have been told many times by your new co-workers, that the Commissioned Corps of the U.S. Public Health Service, the Corps, now commissions medical, dental, and mental health providers to staff the Bureau of Prisons, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Department of Immigrations, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, the Health Resources and Services Administration, the Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Administration, the Indian Health Service, and the Coast Guard. Many of the staff at Lapway were commissioned officers, including my Rilke reading friend Ellen Barton, the nurse practitioner and medical director, who held the rank of captain, Carl Haskins, one of the physicians from the Lumbee tribe of North Carolina, Alan Steinmetz, a pharmacist, Barry Adkins, a lab technician, Joe McDonald and Nick Angelo, the dentists, Juanita Blackhawk, the dental hygienist, and Mike Flanagan and Toby Perez, the mental health social workers, all came to Wednesday staff meetings in Navy issue uniforms, creased midnight blue trousers, matching shirts with epaulettes and gold bars on the collars, shiny patent shoes, and an officer's hat with an imposing yellow caduceus instead of an anchor, better known as scrambled eggs. Ellen and Juanita were required to wear their hair off their necks and limit their jewelry to a wedding band, if they had one, and post earrings. The men had to remain clean-shaven, although Barry Adkins eventually challenged this rule by growing a beard George Michael style. They owned summer whites and dress blues, work khakis for every day if they preferred them to street clothes and lab jackets. Commissioned officers received full military benefits, quarters and subsistence allowances, 30 days annual leave, unlimited sick leave, VA housing loans, free medical care, free military flight privileges, and a 20-year eligibility for retirement. In exchange for a 4-year contract, the PHS offered me a $5,000 sign-on bonus. For a 2-year commitment, they offered to repay all $25,000 of my student loans. It seemed foolish not to enlist, but I'd already been owned by one man, and I was hesitant to enslave myself to the likes of Uncle Sam. Still, after a year of working as a civil servant, in order to take advantage of an additional $5,000 recruitment bonus, I signed on and was commissioned as a lieutenant. The details and acronyms were dizzying either way. In addition to Mr. Picone, the Service Unit Director, or SUD, I now had a CO, or Commanding Officer, in Ellen Barton, and an AO, or Administrative Officer, in a woman from the Yakima Nation named Inez Campbell. My orientation required hours in Inez's office, filling out forms proclaiming over and over that I was now an employee of the DHHS, PHS, IHS, NISU. Eddie Dakota, a dark, bearded, half-Sioux, half-Norwegian bachelor farmer who was the criminal investigator for the BIA, or Bureau of Indian Affairs, took my fingerprints for the FBI. Then there was the GSA, A&D, TARO, the MCH, the CHRs. Letters clinic and tribal employees seemed to relish being asked to translate. And I, of course, was the PHN, or public health nurse. And there were forms for everything, inter-office memos in quadruplicate carbon, mail requisition forms, material requisitions, work requisitions, patient flow sheets, patient service reports, problem charts, patient progress reports, needs assessments, quality control assessments, general epidemiological reports, immunization tracking forms. Some were merely photocopies of a locally produced original, some darkly printed at a Washington, D.C. government printing office on paper resembling newsprint. These made me feel short of breath, as though they were a top-secret thing to which I should not be privy. Looking back, I was likely just allergic to the ink. Then there was NEPTIC, the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Council, the path to which was flanked by crackling weeds on the day Inez, a fastidious slender woman with reddened hair and pale beige skin, who had the curious habit of carrying rags made from torn bedsheets for blowing her nose, walked me over to be met. It was still October, my first week on the job, and I had yet to be summoned to Dodie Kicking Woman's house to intervene before she marbleized from her own feces. NEPTIC chambers were housed in the agency, which outwardly at least looked as inelegant as other HUD-sanctioned buildings in the area. Inside the agency, however, the floors were tastefully tiled and carpeted, the walls painted in soothing earth tones and studded with framed and matted daguerreotypes of native men and women and original oil and acrylic abstracts. Inez opened the door into a paneled room where a stark polished wood table and perhaps 20 overstuffed leather swivel chairs ate into tan carpeting. A dozen men with braided hair and fancy ribbon shirts and women in bright executive jackets and gold jewelry leaned at various angles. The brass smell of coffee escaped from cups. A woman took notes on a stenotype machine. Sun stabbed pasteurizing blades through a crack in the drapes. Inez pointed me toward a row of chairs. I felt like a Peace Corps volunteer. Too blonde, too healthy, too much of a guilty as charged American out for one more life adventure. At least I knew better than to say my grandparents were Cherokee. After 45 minutes of council business, the man seated at the head of the table asked Inez to state the nature of her business. He was round-faced, squat but good-looking, and wore a beaded medallion bumping against his beribbon calico shirt. This, I thought, is what they did with things the white people traded for land. The engraved gold plate on the table featured the man's name followed by the word chairman. We stood, and Inez introduced me. "This is Patricia," she said. "Patricia is the new PHN. She's a wonderful nurse, and we are very happy to have her." Inez went on to elaborate my meager qualifications. In response, members of the NEPTEC introduced themselves one by one, detailing their paid position descriptions and volunteer roles as part of the tribe's government. Sam Lawyer, Sophelia Juilliard, Al Highwater Jr., Willard Moon, Carla Penny, David Williams, all spoke in taut syllables, polite, respectful, gentle enough that I stopped feeling the color of my skin. The circle was nearly complete, introductions having reached the last wizened curlicue of an old man whose long white braids and shrunken torso looked like those of the man who peered through my car window at Valley Foods the day Brett and Zach were beaten up. "My name is Al Highwater Sr.," he said, "and you can give me a shot anytime." All was silence for a moment, then someone burst out laughing. It was several minutes before everyone stopped laughing. Al Highwater Sr.'s cackled like a goose. The Kleenex box went around, people blowing noses, the women checking their mascara, the ice broken. Sophia Juilliard concluded with words of welcome and praise, stressing the importance of the PHN position to the Nez Perce people. "We'll let you settle in," she said, "and then we'll work you to the bone, eh?" Following Inez out of the agency and across the weeds to the clinic, scruffy reservation dogs stiffing our heels and shins, I traced the edges of the word sycophant and understood at long last, perhaps since the days of anthropology classes at Eastern Oregon State College, where I briefly studied the Cheyenne, and the long mildewy afternoons of my Indiana childhood spent twirling Queen Anne's lace between my fingers and popping the soft, nubby seed heads from the long stems of plantain, imagining my status as a savior of Indians, that I did not need to be one. The facility engineering staff at the Indian Health Service Clinic at Lapway consisted entirely of Moose. Moose was from the Spokane tribe, caught his wavy dark ponytail with an elastic band, wore Levi jeans with silkscreen t-shirts under an old denim jacket, sometimes a bandana tied at his neck. The t-shirts usually doubled as an advertisement, a powwow or fun run, a warrior dance, Native American vets. He smoked a traditional mixture he called Indian tobacco made from leaves and barks gathered in the Bitterroot Mountains, which he rolled in drum papers and which Leonard Wahobin, my office mate who had warned me about flaunting my Cherokee-ness during that initial trial visit to the reservation, referred to as wacky tobacco. Early in January, approximately 4 months after my arrival at Lapway, I wandered across the north edge of the parking lot to see Moose blowing at his cupped hands and stomping steel-toed work boots against the chill in the new shop he'd just finished building and siding in T-111. Composite board with vertical grooves, government subsidy signature siding used on HUD housing, Farmers Home Administration houses, and apparently tribal agencies and Indian Health Service clinics. In the 1980s, early in our marriage, Mark and I had built a house on an FMHA loan. A rural police officer's salary easily qualified us, and we were threatened with losing our reduced interest rate if we switched that telltale siding. After sharing the latest blonde joke, "You know how you can tell if a blonde's been using the computer? White out on the screen, isn't it?" Moose tinkered while I delivered in breathless detail yet another phone call I'd just received from Zach's teacher. Not only had Zach bloodied a nose on the playground, but he was arriving to class pearl-legged, in shorts, alarming to the teacher since the Lewis Clark Valley was buckling under a rare frigid spell. Alarming to me since Zach was in blue jeans when I marshaled him next door to await departure time with the neighbor woman and her two children. Apparently he was dressing in layers, racing at warp speed ahead of the other kids running to catch the school bus, then dropping behind a stand of bushes, switching clothes, putting the extras in his backpack. Moose gathered his brow for a second and then asked me to do a very strange thing. "Name the directions," he said. I asked him to repeat himself. "Name the directions. You who have been to school and to college, tell me the names of all the directions." Well, that was easy enough. North, south, east, and west. "See," he said, "that's the problem. You've learned to walk through life like it was a road map, like getting from Spalding to Kooski." Having just a few days prior taken my tour of the reservation with Leonard Wahoban, I knew Moose was referencing the two towns marking the longest distance on the reservation, the two tips on the narrow points of a diamond. "Indians believe the walk is a circle," he said, "and you can't make a circle without one half looking just like the other half just did, only in reverse, isn't it?" Moose finished rolling his cigarette, fumbled through a pile of washers, bolts, and empty matchbooks on his work table. "You need to learn to think like an Indian," he continued. "An Indian has seven directions. The first one," he said, "is the east. And you have to think about that one because that's where everything starts. Every day, every morning, everything starts all over again. And every day, things will either change or stay the same, even if you yourself do nothing." Moose continued to talk, still looking apparently for a match or lighter. "Never light sweetgrass or tobacco or sage with a lighter," he said. "Always use a match. Keep it natural." "Next," he said, matchbook finally in hand, "is north. North is clean and white because of snow and cold. No germs, no nothing. Indians know it's good to lay down in snow. It wakes you up, makes you feel alive. But stay too long and it'll kill you. You gotta get up. Move on."
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
Ollie, oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be naked and ashamed.
Dress your soul, mama.
You were always beautiful to me.
Dress your soul.
You were always beautiful.
Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.